Hi, Marco Werman here. One of the things we pride ourselves on at The World is our approach to the news. The stories are often interconnected and complex, but we know you get it. Our key areas of focus, such as migration, climate change, public health, and global security, often have ripple effects. Because of the time and care we invest in our reporting, our correspondents are able to draw out these important connections for you. Take Carolyn Beeler's reporting that connected the war in Ukraine with European climate targets, or Halima Gakande's reporting on the impact extreme drought in Somalia has on migration, or Joy Hackel's superb work as a producer, lining up people for me to speak with all across Ukraine. Listener support helps us connect you each day with the news. If you've already donated, thank you so much for investing in our work. If you haven't donated and you value the independent, nuanced journalism from The World, I hope you'll make a gift today. You can donate at theworld.org/give or follow the link in our episode notes. And if you're able, I hope you'll consider making a monthly donation to keep us going all year long. Learn more and donate at theworld.org/give. Thanks. And now, the show.
Support for this podcast comes from Wise, the smart way to move money internationally. Meet Wise, one account for over 50 currencies, because today your life is bigger than one currency. Whether you're sending pesos to your parents, receiving dollars from a friend, or spending in euros, you can do it all in one account. With Wise, you can manage your money across borders cheaper, faster, and easier. Join 13 million people and businesses who are already saving, and try Wise for free at wise.com/world.
Colombians were partying in the streets last night as voters ushered in the country's first left-wing president, an election for change in Colombia. I'm Carol Hills. Also on the program today, Indians are protesting changes to military hiring that are crushing dreams of careers in the service.
There is a lot of anger that, you know, we were waiting for this much time and we are not getting an opportunity now.
And starting over in the U.S., meet Afghan women who escaped Taliban rule and are now studying at the University of Wisconsin.
We had to fight for our rights. We want to continue our education. We want to continue our life.
Those stories and more ahead on The World. I'm Carol Hills. You're listening to The World. Thanks for joining us on this Juneteenth holiday. We start off our show today in Colombia. There were cheers and carnival-like celebrations on the streets of Bogotá last night after Colombian voters elected a progressive president for the first time in the country's history. Senator Gustavo Petro narrowly defeated real estate millionaire Rodolfo Hernández in an election where voters favored political outsiders. The World's Latin America correspondent Jorge Valencia is in Bogotá, and he's been covering the election. Jorge, first of all, tell us who Gustavo Petro is and why this election is such a big moment in Colombia.
Yeah, Gustavo Petro is a senator and a former mayor of Bogotá, so he is certainly no newcomer to politics. But he got his start as a member of a military guerrilla group that eventually demobilized and became a political party. So his being elected signals that to at least half of Colombian voters, the type of proposals that he's making that are substantial tax, agricultural, health, educational reforms, that those kind of proposals are no longer associated with military guerrilla groups like the one that he used to be a member of. Here's how he opened his victory speech.
Es historia lo que estamos escribiendo en este momento, una historia nueva para Colombia.
Petro right here saying, we are writing a new chapter in history for Colombia, for Latin America. So certainly the significance of this moment is not lost in him.
Petro's victory is also a significant moment in Colombian history because of his running mate, Francia Márquez. She's the country's first black female vice president. She's even more of an outsider than he is, right?
Yes, she is. This is her first time in elected office. Her background is in community activism. She is from a majority black community in southwestern Colombia. She cleaned houses to work her way through law school. And here's a little bit of what she said last night.
Vamos por la paz de manera decidida, sin miedo con amor y con alegría.
You can hear very much how powerful and gifted of a public speaker Francia Márquez is right here. She's belaboring one of the main points that she said during the campaign, that they want to bring peace to Colombia without fear, but with love and with happiness.
Now, reaction in Colombia, I imagine, is pretty split. Petro won just a little over 50% of the vote. How are people reacting?
Well, there is for sure a large group of voters who are concerned about Petro's victory. One of the main things is that people are concerned that he is going to plunder the country and he is going to bring it into collapse, and that he might even seek to change the constitution so he can be reelected indefinitely, very much like the government of Nicolás Maduro in neighboring Venezuela. But last night on the streets of Colombia, the mood was very much of joy and celebration. Here is Eliana Vázquez. She's from Bogotá.
Hace muchos años, muchos años esperando este triunfo del cambio verdadero.
Vázquez is saying that she has been waiting for many years for a political outsider to rise to the presidential office in Colombia. And she and a lot of people were actually quite emotional about this. Here is somebody else from Bogotá. His name is Fabián Espinel.
Yo creo que es el mejor día de mi vida. Se lo juro. A lo bien, sí.
So right here, Espinel is saying that this is the happiest day in his life. And I was actually kind of incredulous. I said, really? And he said, yes, absolutely. I have never been so happy about a new president coming to the country. So this very much sums up a lot of the feeling that was on the streets last night.
Wow. So finally, how does Petro's victory fit in with presidential politics elsewhere in Latin America?
Well, this fits into a trend of voters across Latin America electing politicians who are presenting very much left-leaning rhetoric, like, for example, in Mexico, Honduras, Peru, Chile, and some of these presidents actually congratulated Gustavo Petro last night, as did U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken.
Jorge Valencia is the world's Latin America correspondent. Thanks a lot, Jorge.
You're welcome, Carol.
Witnesses say victims of violence in central Ethiopia over the weekend are being buried in mass graves. The exact death toll is unclear, but witnesses say 100 or possibly more than 200 people have been killed. The victims were mostly members of the Amhara ethnic group. These deaths are the latest as ethnic violence spills over from the country's Tigray region into other parts of Ethiopia. Bystanders say members of an Oromo rebel group were responsible for the killings. They deny responsibility. William Davison has been monitoring this. He's a senior analyst with the International Crisis Group and joins us from Nairobi. William, what can you tell us about the violent attack over the weekend?
This is reported to have occurred on Saturday, and it's very much as you described. I think it's important to note the context here. Yes, we've had the incredible violence of the Tigray War, but there has been an ongoing insurgency by the Oromo Liberation Army, mostly inside Oromia region. That's been ongoing for around 2 years now, and a very violent government counterinsurgency as well. So tragically, this sort of violence is not new. And indeed, these reports of a massacre of sort of minority Amhara communities inside Oromia, that also fits into a pattern.
I understand some Amhara people are now asking to be moved to safer ground. Can you tell me whether anything's happened on that score?
There have been many, many Amhara people displaced in Oromia, as well as other civilians. And then it's not just in Oromia region that we've had mass displacement. But as I mentioned, these attacks on Amhara minority communities in Oromia, they have been a feature of the violence. And so unsurprisingly, Amhara, ethnic Amhara citizens are not feeling safe in Oromia. But like I say, obviously, that also goes for other communities around the country.
What's been the federal government's response so far to these attacks on the Amhara?
I would say intensifying efforts by the federal security forces, also Oromia region security forces, to sort of eliminate the Oromo Liberation Army rebel group. They are seen as the perpetrators. That is the primary response that the government has made. And there have also been obviously efforts to cater for displaced people. More broadly, the government is planning to host, facilitate a national dialogue to try and address some of the political problems, the communal problems at the root of this political violence. But those efforts so far have not gathered that much momentum.
William, I want to zoom out a bit for a second. Ethiopia is comprised of more than 100 million people and about 80 different ethnic groups. What's typically the source of tension between these groups?
There's no one easy answer for that. I think that a lot of this violence does have a political root to it, as in different political factions, different political communities, some of them, you know, ethnic, some of them sort of ethno-regional. They have different demands for their fair share of power as they see it, or they have autonomy demands. Perhaps they have grievances which they consider not to have been answered. So that leads to a lot of political contestation, which has obviously spilled over increasingly into violence in Oromia, and then, you know, in this spectacular fashion, the civil war between Tigray region and the federal government.
Where do you see this going in terms of the stability of this, of the federal government, of the central government, and these various groups?
Obviously, this sort of inclination towards negotiations rather than trying to find a military solution in Tigray, that's somewhat positive, but, you know, there's very much accompanying challenges and risks with that process. And then we also have the situation in Oromia, as we've discussed, which seems to be deteriorating and increasing intercommunal tensions, really, between Oromo and Amhara factions, the two biggest communities. And I think from our perspective at International Crisis Group, we've argued really the only way to start addressing some of these fundamental political problems is through sort of comprehensive and inclusive negotiations. Instead, what we see at the moment is a tendency to try and exclude political opponents, marginalize, or completely defeat and eradicate them. That seems to be feeding a cycle of violence.
William Davison is a senior analyst with the International Crisis Group. He joined us from Nairobi. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
One of the many ripple effects of the war in Ukraine is that a number of European countries are now trying to wean themselves off of Russian energy. Over the weekend, Germany announced new measures to reduce its reliance on Russian gas in the long term. Part of its strategy is to turn back to coal. We're joined now by Andreas Schroeder. He's the head of energy analytics at ICIS, Independent Commodity Intelligence Services. Andreas, this sounds like Germany's moving backwards where energy is concerned. Why is it re-embracing coal?
Yeah, it's completely upside down to what we've done the years previously. So we've phased out coal just to bring it back now again. It's a bit of a change of paradigm now. So we got to take measures that wouldn't be possible a few years ago.
So why is re-embracing coal a way to help wean Germany off of Russian gas?
Gas and coal, they are both used in power plants, so they are competing with each other, and they can be used as substitute as well. So we do have a lot of coal plants running idle at the moment. They've been phased out or mothballed in the past years, but they could easily be reactivated now at low cost. That's low-hanging fruit to cope with the situation, so to say, to wean ourselves off Russian gas.
So is the idea to reopen some coal power plants and use coal as a way to preserve the gas you already have from Russia, kind of store it for use next winter?
Yeah, it's a way to store more gas into our storage. So this is very important for the upcoming winter. Gas storage is a way to protect ourselves against any risks. And also we have a very much winter peaking gas demand. So this is super important to have gas in storage for the winter.
Now, I'm wondering if there's been pushback on this idea of going back to coal.
Yeah, because we still stick to our ambition of climate neutrality in a few decades. So bringing back coal is somehow counterintuitive now, and it doesn't lead us the way to our climate target. So there's a huge backlash against that, and a lot of resistance as well in the public space. So it has to be debated. But also we do understand now the situation is very much like a crisis, so we have to take uncomfortable measures.
I'm curious how Germany is doing generally getting off of its dependence on natural gas from Russia. I mean, before the war, Germany got more than half of its natural gas from Russia. How has it managed to reduce its dependence so far? What other steps has it taken?
So first of all, the gas flows from Russia to Germany have been decreased, and Germany does so by switching to other sources of gas and also by reducing demand for gas to some extent. Yeah, so people are not heating now, or they are heating a bit less, and industry is also switching off some plants, especially for nutrition and fertilizer production also. So those are ways how to address the gas crisis. Yeah, so we want to reduce consumption and find new sources of supply.
What is the long-term plan for how Germans will heat their homes? Is it renewables or what is it?
Yeah, so the long-term plan is a switch towards renewable heating in homes. There's heat pumps, which are already economical by now. And so the government wants to push, subsidizes a lot of refurbishment at home and renovations about heating facilities as well.
Are Germans' concerns about getting through next winter, are they big enough to overcome their ambivalence about going back to coal at this point?
Yeah, so I think there's a lot of fear that Russia will not deliver enough gas for the winter to come. And so there is some acceptance to reconsider our climate goals and to move back to coal for temporarily. So this is a temporary measure. And for that, I think the majority of Germans will accept this.
Andreas Schroeder is the head of energy analytics at ICIS. He's been speaking with us about Germany's new energy plans, which include a re-embrace of coal. Thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks a lot.
Coming up, Israel looks poised for yet another election. You're listening to The World. I'm Carol Hills. You're with The World. Israeli Prime Minister Naftali Bennett announced today that he'll be dissolving his coalition government. The move will be made official with a vote in parliament in the coming days. This would bring down the government and send Israel into its fifth election in just 3 years. Reporter Ariel Osaran has been following the story. He joins us now from Tel Aviv. Ariel, why is Naftali Bennett dissolving his government?
Well, Carol, the long and short of it is that the heads of the current government realize that they can't keep going on the way they're going right now. The majority was lost back in April, and it's very difficult for them to pass even the simplest of laws. And so what happened tonight is that Prime Minister Bennett and Foreign Minister Yair Lapid, the two heads of the current government, the so-called change government, have agreed to hold a vote on dissolving Israel's parliament, the Knesset, next week. This will probably happen Monday. Bennett and Lapid stood together on TV thanking each other, saying that they'll do the most that they can to help in this transitional period. They even said that they love each other, which is a very stark contrast to what we saw the previous government handled itself. Now, sorry for the spoiler, but there really is no need for suspense. The law will pass and the Knesset will be dissolved. After that, it's elections in late October. And this just shows that the worst political crisis in Israel's history is still not over.
I also know tonight former Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu went on Israeli television. Ariel, what's Benjamin Netanyahu saying?
Basically, Netanyahu was gloating here. He called this an evening of great news, ending a year of suffering for millions of Israelis. He called this the most dysfunctional government in the country's history. And I have to say, he's not really wrong about that, given the really hard time it was for them to pass laws of late. Now, Israel's governing coalition, which saw the unlikely cooperation of a bunch of parties from the right all the way to Israel's first ever Arab party in government, they all united under one goal: to remove long-term Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu from power. He is currently the head of the opposition, and so it did work, at least for now. And now Netanyahu will have another shot at a dramatic fourth quarter comeback. But if it doesn't work, this could perhaps be his final round of trying to lead Israel.
And how will all of this affect President Biden's planned visit to the Middle East next month?
Well, in terms of substance, I'm not sure how much, but as far as who will be greeting him, that will be different. It is now going to be Foreign Minister Yair Lapid, who will become caretaker prime minister until the new government is sworn in. He will be the one to meet with President Joe Biden next month when he visits the region.
Reporter Ariel Osaran in Tel Aviv updating us on the news that Israel may be facing elections yet again. Thanks, Ariel.
Thanks, Carol.
When the Taliban retook Afghanistan last summer, women feared they would once again be shut out of academic life. About 150 Afghans studying at the Asian University for Women were evacuated to the United States. They spent their first few months at Fort McCoy in Wisconsin. After that, they were sent to universities around the U.S. to study. Eight of them are now in an intensive English program at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee, preparing for the fall term. WUWM education reporter Emily Files met some of them and has this report.
On a recent afternoon, five Afghan refugees are working on their English with instructor Jennifer Mattson.
Fat. 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 Fat.
The students seem upbeat and chatty, but these young women are still reeling at how their lives have changed. We're using only the students' first names to protect their families in Afghanistan. Here's 20-year-old Marok.
It is not easy to just build a new life for yourself. Even I know that we have to just start this to build a life for ourselves, but still, we have lots of concerns.
The students escaped Afghanistan due to the efforts of their school, the Asian University for Women in Bangladesh, which was holding remote classes at the time. It was a harrowing few days as they tried multiple times to enter the packed Kabul airport. 21-year-old Farzana says she almost gave up hope.
I didn't believe. I just said, that's it. It's over. It's over. I cannot make it. I will be like my mom. I will be like my mom, just to spend a whole of my life inside the home and be invisible.
Farzana says during the final escape attempt, she had to leave her home with just 15 minutes notice. Her mother wasn't there, so she couldn't say goodbye.
I just called her and I said, I'm gonna leave again. I'm gonna try again. So it was very sad for me. I didn't say goodbye.
Leaving their families behind was the hardest thing they've ever done. But 21-year-old Tahara says it was their only choice.
We lost everything that we had in Afghanistan, but we had to fight for our rights. That we want to continue our education, we want to continue our life. If we stayed in Afghanistan, it was really hard for every girl.
Now they're continuing their education here in Milwaukee. University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee got involved because of its intensive English program, which prepares international students to earn a degree at an English-speaking university. English Language Academy Director Brooke Haley says UWM was eager to help.
So this is the first time that UWM has taken in refugees like this. And when we first had the ask, it was for a 5-year full scholarship, a year of language study, up to a year of language study, and then 4 years of undergraduate study.
UWM couldn't provide that level of financial support, but it did discount the English program by 40%. The rest of the tuition costs are coming from a local church, which is also providing host families for the students.
It's a great example of a public university like UWM working with private, even religious, organizations in the community for a common goal.
The church is fundraising for the first year of the students' undergrad studies at UWM, which they'll start in the fall after completing the English program. Before, the students say they had 5-year full scholarships at the Asian University for Women. Farzana says she worries about being able to afford a 4-year degree at UWM.
I'm very thankful of the people here and everyone that they are supporting us. But I'm just saying that, well, we have very stressful life. We have many stresses, many things to think about. And then this is also one of the things that we have to think about.
Marok uses a metaphor to describe it, saying it's like carrying stones. One stone is worrying about their family. Another is worrying about their country. Adding a third stone, the uncertainty about their own futures, won't break them.
It can change the girls who have a dream from Afghanistan. We are that much strong to just start a new journey in a different country.
They still have dreams, even though leaving Afghanistan has altered them. Marok wants to work for Doctors Without Borders. Farzana wants to be an advocate for refugees who have no say in the wars that displace them. She wants to help people like herself and her friends. For The World, I'm Emily Files in Milwaukee.
Later in the show, the only known remains of an African independence leader are finally returned home. You're listening to The World.
Hong Kong has changed dramatically since mainland China started limiting political freedoms there. The airport, for one, is a lot quieter, except for the sounds of people leaving the island for good.
Once you get to the departure gate, there's this crowd of people and everyone's sort of teary and they're saying their last goodbyes. And it was very jarring to witness.
A view of the city's transformation from one longtime resident ahead on the world. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. We're a co-production of GBH and PRX. For more than 30 years, people in China were only allowed to have one child. That led to a massive drop in the country's birth rate. Last year, the government changed the rules. Now, up to three children are allowed. The World's Rebecca Kanther in Shanghai looks at how China's attempts to grow its population are impacting access to abortion.
Christina Wang is the mother of two children. Her second, a daughter, was born before China's one-child policy was changed. And because she was worried about losing her job, she considered having an abortion. I was just a mess for 3 months. I just couldn't make a decision, she says. I went to the hospital and the doctor asked, "Do you want to keep it?" I kept going back and forth, but finally I decided to have the baby, she says. Having a second child had consequences for Wang and her family. She had to quit her job at a university, and she couldn't get identity papers for her child because she'd have to pay a heavy fine. Her parents were upset with her for having a second child. But actually, they did the same thing decades earlier when her mother was pregnant with her after their birth control failed. My mom was the same, she says. She wasn't supposed to have me. After I was born, she was sterilized and docked a year's salary. But luckily, she was not forced to have an abortion. Many others were, though. For more than 30 years, China enforced the one-child policy. Women had to apply for permission to give birth and prove that they didn't have any other children. Illegal abortions and forced abortions were common. Yi Fuxian remembers that time. So many women who were being threatened with forced abortions would reach out to me for advice, he says. Yi is a demographer at the University of Wisconsin. Back in 2000, he began a crusade against China's one-child policy, arguing that it was completely unnecessary to lower the fertility rate. He wrote articles online and recommended the government abandon the policy altogether. At the time, his views were not welcome, and a book he wrote on the topic was banned. He says the government didn't realize how serious China's population crisis would become. They were afraid of an explosion in population growth and worried the healthcare system couldn't handle it. So they chose to regulate the number of births, he says. In China, boys have long been heavily favored, so many parents would secretly abort female fetuses. Single women often turned to abortion too. Now, China has one of the highest abortion rates in the world. Advertisements for facilities that provide abortions can be seen around the country. In this commercial for a women's hospital in Fuzhou, a woman in a pink business suit speaks to the camera. Accidents can happen to young women, she says, but at that crucial moment, you can rest easy. Then a man's voice continues. Gentle and painless abortions available. During the years of the one-child policy, the annual rate of abortions hovered around 35% of all pregnancies, according to official government statistics. Yi says these statistics actually underestimate the number of terminated pregnancies in China, because they don't include all the illegal gender selection abortions. Now, as a result of the failed one-child policy, China is saddled with a whole stack of problems. An extreme gender imbalance, a declining birth rate, and a quickly aging population. Last year, the government changed the policy to allow three kids, but it wasn't the quick fix they hoped for. China's birth rate has continued to drop. Christina Wang says few women want to have more children. Don't even talk about three kids, she says. No one even wants a second child. Because the costs of raising a child are just too much, and there's little social support, she says. Earlier this year, China's Family Planning Association announced that they would take measures to reduce the number of abortions for unmarried women. Yi, the demographer, says now the government is trying to swing the pendulum back in the other direction. The government used to encourage abortion, and in some cases would do forced abortion, he says. But now, they're trying to limit abortions. Now, in hospitals, it isn't as easy to get an abortion. Instead, they want to encourage women to give birth, he says. But that's easier said than done. It's easy to force people not to give birth, he says. But to force people to have children, that's impossible, he says. For The World, I'm Rebecca Canther in Shanghai.
Writer and journalist Karen Chung misses many things about everyday life in Hong Kong. She misses them even though she still lives there. Over the last few years, Chung has watched as her hometown has been transformed into a place she barely recognizes. She writes about the changes in her new book, The Impossible City, a Hong Kong memoir. Karen Chung, listeners will remember the waves of pro-democracy protests that swept through Hong Kong in 2019. They were in response to Beijing starting to pass laws that threatened political freedom in Hong Kong. Do you remember what you felt like in 2019 when you were out there protesting?
In the beginning, it was really just electrifying to be out in the crowd and marching with a lot of people. And then as the months progressed, there was a lot more violence on the streets. And so you started getting very worried about the safety of the people who are out there. And also the clashes between the protesters and police became a lot more often. And it got a lot more bleak towards the end of it, because you really could be, for instance, shopping in a mall and the police would be, for instance, charging in and rounding people up, sometimes for singing. And so that mood changes very significantly towards the end.
Can you imagine Hong Kongers going out in the streets today like they did in 2019?
No. So partly that has to do with the national security law. And after they outlawed a number of offenses, that coupled with the pandemic, there were a lot of public health regulations that limited the number of people that could be gathering on the streets at a time. So that has increasingly felt very improbable.
What sort of everyday activities might you have done in 2019 that just aren't possible now?
Yeah, a lot of the so-called discourse around Hong Kong and discussions about politics happens online, and a lot of people really are much more careful about what they are expressing on social media. And another thing is very palpable is just because of the number of pro-democracy newspapers and media outlets have closed down, even just our major news sources for what was going on, you know, I can't even really go onto Instagram and look at their feeds and see what happened in the morning. And that was something that I used to do.
I want to ask about one very big symbol, which is the Hong Kong International Airport. I understand that's undergone a lot of change. It used to be one of the busiest hubs in the world. What's it like now?
That was like a place that I would go to all the time ever since I was a child. And it's always been very, very busy. You know, the terminals are filled with people. You have to queue for a very long time to check in. And it's always been the center of activity. And when I was there in April, really the only noise that was coming from the entire airport is the one or two check-in counters that are open for the flights, and also the departure gates, because despite the fact that there really weren't that many flights coming in and out of Hong Kong at the time, there were still a lot of people immigrating. And every time you have one person say goodbye to Hong Kong forever, you know, they would bring about 30 different friends all there to say goodbye to them. It was very eerie because the place was so empty. But then once you get to the departure gate, there's this crowd of people and everyone's sort of teary and they're saying their last goodbyes. And it was very jarring to witness.
I know June is a month when Hong Kong residents used to gather in Hong Kong's Victoria Park to commemorate the Tiananmen Square massacre. What was that event like in years past?
It's like one of those dates where every single year when it comes up, you know that that's where you'll be in the evening. And the key, I think, scene in the June 4th commemoration is really everybody would be clutching these little paper cups, and the little paper cups are to catch the wax. And it's because it's a candle-like vigils, and it's a fair amount of singing of songs. And yeah, it was very much a regular program that I think we all just took for granted was always going to be part of it.
What happened on the June Tiananmen anniversary this year?
For the past year, organizers and people who showed up to the commemoration they were arrested and the organizers also disbanded. So there isn't a central organizing body anymore. And so effectively, there wasn't a commemoration.
There have been so many arrests. How many young people in the circles you know are in jail now?
About a dozen, I would say. So it ranges from people that I briefly know in summer camp before university to people that I really only know because of my previous job as a reporter, and some of them are for protest-related charges.
What about you, Karen? How are you weighing the decision about whether and how long to stay in Hong Kong?
It's a question that's sort of in flux for me every single day. You know, I've lived here my whole life. I can't really think of a reason to be anywhere else. You know, when all the political changes were happening, it was like, okay, most people in my generation felt like they wanted to be here to play their part. And then afterwards, it becomes a situation of a lot of the people around you are leaving and you are not sure what else is to be done within Hong Kong anymore. And so it becomes an issue of almost guilt. And I don't think guilt is necessarily a very helpful emotion. I think it hinders in some ways.
Is even doing an interview like this a risk for you?
Yeah, it can be. That's why sometimes it takes me a pause to sort of figure out what I am saying in my head that that's not going to potentially be a huge problem. It is something that I consider, and I think a lot of people consider.
Karen Chung has been speaking with us from Hong Kong. She's the author of Impossible City, a Hong Kong memoir. Thanks a lot, Karen.
Thank you.
Catch up with the news we've been reporting on lately. In the UK, doctors are prescribing social activities for their patients. It's an effort to fight an epidemic of loneliness. Think tea parties and dancing. And ahead of a presidential election, the Kenyan government is warning about the spread of disinformation and hate speech on social media. Those stories and more on our website, theworld.org. In India, protests against a new military hiring plan have turned deadly. At least one person has been killed and 300 arrested in the southern Indian state of Telangana. Protests erupted around the country last week after the Indian military launched a new policy that would limit service terms for most new recruits to 4 years. Joining us now from Bengaluru, India, is Pranay Kotastane. He's chair of high-tech geopolitics at the Takshashila Institution, a public policy think tank. So help us understand, what exactly does this new policy change and why is it so unpopular?
So what this new policy does, it's called Agnipath or a tour of duty scheme, where basically people are employed for a short-term service like it is in other countries, even in the US, even in France, etc. The soldiers are basically recruited for a period of 4 years and only 25% of those recruits continue to do the full-term service, which is approximately 15 to 16 years. And 75% of the people just go outside after serving for 4 years.
So the current policy, a person would enlist and then serve in the military for 15 years and then get generous pension and other benefits. And so cutting it to 4 really changes the whole promise of a job in the military.
That's true. Yes, that's the change. And the big thing is that if you serve for 15 years, you get government pensions, gratuity, etc. Whereas if you serve for the 4 years, you don't get a pension gratuity, but you do get a good send-off package. So that's the whole bone of contention. A lot of people have been applying for government jobs. It's a big deal in India, especially in some areas. So I wouldn't say the protests are happening all over India. They are happening in certain pockets where there is a lot of expectations from government jobs and there aren't other alternatives.
So what's the government's goal here?
Basically, the motivation is fiscal and financial. Essentially, what has happened is the current status quo is really not sustainable. Personnel costs, which is salary plus pension, have been growing at a much faster rate than the defense budget itself. And that has been cutting down on our capital outlay or modernization expenditure. So the army or especially is becoming more and more dependent on people, but we don't have the money to spend on technology, new equipment, etc. So there have been lots of talks about doing a reform which cuts down the number of personnel and instead has a larger spending on the cutting edge technology or equipment. So this is one of those steps in order to get to that stage where you don't have a big army and you also have better equipment.
You know, I'm curious, China is this kind of huge power in the world and it's a growing military power. Does this reform, which seems to be focused on fewer soldiers, better equipment, better strategy, does it have anything to do with Indian tensions with China?
It has everything to do with Indian tensions in China, in the sense that over the last few decades, India's main military adversary was Pakistan. But that is sort of moved on from now, like the bigger danger now and the competition now is with China. So a lot of focus is now on trying to combat an adversary which is five times richer than you, which also has a lot better equipment, etc. Right. So now the Indian armed forces are actually undergoing a lot of reform, not just this. There is a lot of talk of theaterization of commands. There's a talk of a chief of defense staff, which will integrate the service. And this is a part of that reform where the government wants to, you know, change the composition and the function of the armed forces.
So the Indian government is getting a lot of blowback for this proposed policy change. Are they responding at all, or are they just going to go ahead?
No, there are already some concessions which have been given, and the government is trying its best to sort of manage the situation. So, for instance, there were a lot of people who were also protesting because they became ineligible to apply even for these jobs because of the age limit. So these jobs are open for people from 17 and a half to 21 years of age. So there were some people who were older than that and could have gotten jobs in a regular scheme, but aren't getting so in the new proposal. So the government has already increased the age limit for these people then to 23. And also there are lots of promises from a few state governments, also from the union government, that they will absorb some of the people who retire after 4 years. So there is a 10% reservation in some paramilitary forces. Some have similarly promised in other police forces as well. So that's how it is being managed.
Pranay Kotastane is at the Takshishila Institution, a public policy think tank. He joined us from Bengaluru, India. Pranay, thanks for speaking with us.
Thank you so much.
Patrice Lumumba was the charismatic Congolese leader who led his country as it gained independence from Belgium in the 1960s. But the breakaway from Belgium was messy. After becoming the Democratic Republic of Congo's first prime minister, Lumumba was executed by a hit squad led by Belgian officials. It was gruesome. Lumumba was buried in a shallow grave, and his remains were virtually erased with sulfuric acid. But somehow, one of his gold-crowned teeth survived. Today, Belgium returned the tooth to the Democratic Republic of Congo and Lumumba's family. Here to talk about the return of Lumumba's only known remains is Georges Enzongola Talaja. He's the Democratic Republic of Congo's representative to the United Nations. Georges, the discovery of Lumumba's tooth is a story in itself. What happened?
Well, the story was known for quite a while because the person who did it, the Belgian police officers who took the tooth, bragged about it openly and was interviewed by researchers, Professor Ludo De Wit, who wrote this really excellent book on Lumumba's assassination.
So it was a Belgian who was involved in Lumumba's assassination who took the tooth after killing him?
Yes, he's the one who sliced his body like an animal, put it into sulfuric acid, and then he took the tooth as a trophy, you know, as a hunter's trophy somehow.
And how did the tooth then end up with Belgian authorities to return to the Lumumba family?
The Belgians, after the publication of Ludo De Wit's book, Lumumba's Assassination, the Belgian authorities learned about this. The Belgian police went and raided the house of the policeman and took the tooth that he had left behind with his daughter.
It's really just an unbelievable story of just heinous behavior. What makes this moment, the return of Lumumba's tooth, so important?
You do have some peace of mind once you know that the remains of your loved ones have been, you know, set to rest in a peaceful place. According to our culture, it is extremely important to bury a dead. We don't like the dead being left to rot in the sun or to be thrown in rivers or lakes. We like to have them buried. And so for the Congolese, it is another important moment in our history to honor this man or this mausoleum and to have a place where people can go and reflect on Lumumba's importance to our country's history, helping our country become independent, and his dream, his vision for the future, which he wasn't able to fulfill.
It's interesting because the Belgians literally tried to erase him from Congolese history.
Exactly. And people would have completely forgotten about it. And I think they didn't want to have a place where people can go and honor Lumumba. This is exactly what we have achieved.
Do you believe Belgium should offer some kind of financial restitution to the Democratic Republic of Congo for its involvement in the political instability there?
Well, I'm speaking for myself and not for the government. But, you know, in my own view, I think that that is something that has to be negotiated, to sit down to see what form reparation should take. It may not necessarily have to be money, but it could be in terms of services, improving the healthcare system, the school systems, infrastructure, roads. For example, we have a country that has no paved roads. You know, there are very few. Those are issues that should be negotiated by the two governments.
Georges Enzongola Talaja is the Democratic Republic of Congo's representative to the United Nations. Thank you so much for speaking with us.
You're very welcome.
The war in Ukraine has wreaked havoc on global wheat supplies. That's because much of the world relies on Ukrainian wheat. Here in the U.S., we grow our own wheat. Still, every slice of American bread can be traced back to Ukraine. The world's Bianca Hillier explains.
Back in the early 1870s, Mennonites left present-day Ukraine and headed to the United States.
As a group, as a village.
Fern Bartle is one of their direct descendants. She says they settled in Gosal, Kansas, because the land was similar to what they were used to back home.
It was the same climate and the same soil type, that kind of thing.
Soon, the group was farming the seeds they'd brought with them, including Turkey red wheat, a hard red winter wheat. It was unlike any other wheat being grown in the U.S. at the time. And Richard Sharman, who operates Palouse Colony Farm in Washington State, says the milling technology wasn't yet up for the job.
The millers didn't like those grains from Ukraine because they were hard on their equipment. But thank goodness somebody finally tasted the flour one day and made bread out of it and said, holy cow, this stuff is incredible.
Compared to the soft wheats grown in the U.S. at the time, Turkey red wheat has more protein, which makes for an overall better loaf of bread. Sharman says it also tastes better.
You know, it has a naturally nutty, sweet taste.
Over the years, milling technology improved. Ukrainian entrepreneurs brought in more shipments of Turkey red wheat.
And that's really how the modern American bread industry got started.
In the early 1900s, Turkey red wheat grew into one of the most popular wheat varieties. It was a major crop planted throughout the Great Plains. But
Turkey red, it had lots of problems.
Tim Riley is a fourth-generation farmer out in western Kansas. His family also moved to the States from the Black Sea region in the late 1800s. He says, originally, Turkey red didn't have disease-resistant properties and didn't yield a large enough crop. It was also tall and had a tendency to fall down at harvest time.
So when you grow Turkey red, you're taking some risk of not maybe having as good a crop or a crop at all.
That's where science came in handy. Over the years, Turkey red was crossbred with other wheat varieties to produce a whole bunch of higher-yielding, disease-resistant modern wheats.
With a few caveats, all the modern wheats that are grown today probably have some kind of Turkey red in its heritage.
In Gosal, Kansas, Fern Bartle puts it another way.
It's the great-grandmother of all the wheat that's out there now.
That legacy has been top of mind for Randy George since the war started in February. He owns Red Hen Baking in Vermont.
When the war started in Ukraine, that was, as a baker, the first thing I thought of, you know, oh, this is such an important place to us.
Today, relatively little pure turkey red wheat is grown in the U.S., but Richard Sharman farms some in Washington. He sells it to local mills, who then market the flour to artisan bakers. Sharman says as the war continues in Ukraine, it's important that people know the backstory of U.S. wheat.
We have a great debt to Ukraine for the very food we eat and for the freedom that we've secured. And I hope that we can stand in solidarity with them in these times of such challenge.
Ukrainians themselves are proud of their history as Europe's breadbasket. The country's flag is blue on the top and yellow on the bottom to symbolize a clear sky above a healthy field of wheat. For The World, I'm Bianca Hillier.
The World comes to you each weekday from the Nan and Bill Harris studio in Boston. You can find us online anytime at theworld.org. I'm Carol Hills. We'll see you back here tomorrow.
Hi, this is Marco. Before I sign off, I want to remind you that The World is fundraising now through June 30th. Listeners like you support our work financially. Because of your help, our newsroom can focus our international reporting on people at the center of global events. Learn more and make your gift at theworld.org/give. That's theworld.org/give. Thank you so much.